This is a paid message from GoFundMe. Meet Juan Naula. When his son was hospitalized for a viral infection, Juan started a GoFundMe to pay for medical expenses.
It was $5,000 to pay the bill for my son, and I needed only 22 hours. It was amazing. People really trust on GoFundMe.
How did Juan raise $5,000 in less than a day? He posted a short video on GoFundMe, telling his story in 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Be specific, be quick, and tell what are you going to be using the funds for. I was nervous to do it because it doesn't feel okay to ask money, but you shouldn't be nervous. Sometimes you just have to do it and see the results. We were able to save my son's life. Thanks to GoFundMe that we still have my son with us.
Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This message reflects one person's experience.
The Claire Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Now, should we have the right to die when we choose? Well, the island of Jersey has approved a law to allow terminally ill adults the right to choose to end their life, while the UK's House of Lords appears to have blocked the legislation, which did pass through the Commons. And if you were listening last week, you might have heard on Friday Esther Ranson's daughter, Rebecca Wilcox, on the programme. And Rebecca told us that she is not happy with the House of Lords.
It has been passed through the Commons twice. It has had over 200 hours of scrutiny, over 150 hours of debate, and yet less than 1% of the House of Lords, less than 1% of all those brilliant lords, ladies, baronesses and peers are saying no to this bill. And we don't know why. It feels like it is a matter of faith, and that is fine because it is their choice to have their faith, but it is not their choice to have my decision made on my death and your decision on your death.
Well, Professor Desmond O'Neill, consultant geriatrician at Tally University Hospital, is here. You're very welcome.
Thanks, Claire.
The shorthand, the terminology, assisted dying, right to die, that doesn't sit with you at all, does it?
Yeah, it makes us uneasy in terms of a caring profession. We're here to support and help people, and particularly around fears for the future. And I think very often this is about fears for the future, fears about dying, fears about disability, and sadly, sometimes prejudice about disability, prejudice that, you know, what will happen to me should I not be able to speak? And indeed, some of the phraseology we've heard from Britain has been very ugly around this area. For example, Joanna Trollope, the author, talking about if I get gaga or go gaga, for life living with dementia. And we know that living with dementia can be a rich experience if we enable and support people. Talking about if I can no longer speak, I would like to be able to die. And again, we've many of our patients with stroke, or indeed often with Alzheimer's disease and dementia, you may have difficulty in retrieving words, but very often we communicate in many other ways. And very often there are ways of facilitating, whether it's through music, through art, through presence. Mm-hmm. So I think what's really concerning here is a personalized, almost eugenics, that there's only one way to live.
Right. But what do you say to the person who has been given a terminal diagnosis and is facing a death, a path to death that frightens them, whether that's because of pain or loss of function? There is, in some jurisdictions, the option, and in other places there is not. There is no right to choose, as Rebecca says.
Yeah, the challenge is that this is a very simplistic approach. And I think the first thing we do is we outline the range of supports that are available. The other thing is people change as they get illness. There's very clear evidence that there's personal growth that occurs that you hadn't anticipated. So our approach is to say, here are the range of supports we're here to provide. We will not give you any burdensome or inappropriate treatments. Again, consent is always there. So, you know, you're not going to be ventilated, you're not going to get tubes, those sort of things. But I think we've got to be mindful of what it does to the framework of care. And I suppose the other challenge is the myth that this can be regulated or the myth that this can be limited.
Why is that a myth?
It's a myth because in pretty much every jurisdiction, once you get to a certain stage, it moves beyond what was stated to be the terminal illness. And indeed, even the terminal illness doctors openly declare, it's widely seen, you cannot predict when somebody's only got 6 months to live. Possibly when they have a few weeks. But the idea, assigning an almost godlike omniscience to us, that we would know when somebody has 6 months or 12 months, people surprise you all the time. But coming back to the question here, I think what happens is very much this happens in the abstract where people are talking about these fears. And our role here is to say, well, what happens? And what happens in other jurisdictions, for example, is there is no regulation. So, for example, in Oregon, which people often talk about, they don't actually go back and ask, was it an appropriate death? Or they only look at a tick-boxing exercise as what medications you gave. You can see that in Canada, in Belgium, the Netherlands, it's moved on to towards mental health. And the other thing is people have this idea of somehow or other of a perfect medical system where everybody does the right thing. Mm-hmm. And you've got to realize you're going into an imperfect system. So, for example, they rolled out a thing called the Liverpool Care Pathway for palliative care. But once that went outside of palliative care expertise, then it went astray. So our most important point here is to direct people towards care. But we
so you're saying if you have the right palliative care, you won't want to make this choice.
What I would say is there will always be these thoughts in people's minds, and we're here to allay them. But the concern from our point of view about talking about rights is we've got to remember that rights, the famous namesake of mine, Honora O'Neill, the philosopher, talks that people talk too much about rights and not about rights and responsibilities. And around our rights, we've got to have an awareness or a sense about what our perceived sense of a right does in terms of responsibility mm-hmm. to the rest. And what we're doing, creating a framework whereby disability is being given a very negative and prejudicial role. So these thoughts will occur.
I want to ask you about your own clinical experience, because I am sure you have had in the course of your career somebody with a painful terminal illness turn to you and say, I want to die.
Well, this may surprise you, and I'm fortunate in the team I have, but I've been working since 1983, so 43 years, and not once. I've seen, perhaps I've been perceiving people, you know, oh, lift this cross from me, mm-hmm. perhaps in the sort of psychosocial environment, but never once have I had a request in any sense about limiting life.
Right.
I've been dealing with people with dementia, with cancer, with stroke. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the studies are all there before you have a stroke. People say, if I have severe stroke and if I can't speak, I really want to die. And afterwards, when they get the stroke, that changes.
Right. Because Esther Ranson's daughter has told us about her mother's plans to go to Dignitas when she reaches that point. She's got terminal lung cancer. And she was very upset on Friday, saying, I won't know when she's taking that trip, because as it stands, if she tells Rebecca about it, Rebecca could be criminally liable for being part of that plan. That is a difficult position to put somebody in, is it not? That they cannot carry out their own wishes in their own country and tell their family about it.
I can see the difficulties, but you got to realise that there's implications for everything. I mean, for example, it's wonderful for somebody to get a kidney transplant. But if that kidney transplant has led to a system in an underdeveloped lower middle income country where people are by poverty giving up their kidney, then we're going, well, maybe that wasn't the best way to do this. So I've written actually in the British Medical Journal about Dignitas and the stress this puts on accompanying relatives. And one of the biggest burden we put on our relatives is to say, I don't want to be a burden. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, the talk about the voting that goes on, you've got to bear in mind that sometimes very simple solutions have a populist tinge to them. So the majority in the UK voted for Brexit, and I think there's a degree of buyer's regret. I think what you might see with MAGA and the USA. So in terms of what might happen in terms of legislature, I think after the debate in the House of Commons, what bothered many of us was people talked about how highly emotional it was. We'd have liked it to be highly rational, and we'd like people to have been more honest, particularly on the side proposing this, when they talk that this can be limited and it can be regulated.
Can it? Like, can you offer choice to people who want to take this option and regulate and safeguard for people who you are concerned about, who might be vulnerable here and be victims of coercion?
Coercion is a real worry. 55 couples in the Netherlands undertook assisted suicide. And Lionel Shriver has written a really wonderful book about this, exploring a husband and wife who decide they will do this in the future and what happens when the day arrives. So there's serious concerns about coercion occurring in this area and can I say, in Oregon, for example, people were meant to have an 18-week engagement with their doctor before this happened. This has dropped down to 3 weeks.
So you're saying you cannot offer choice and legislate successfully to protect people at the same time, that it's just not possible, you believe?
It's absolutely not possible. And the other thing is we change the dial completely. So we make this tolerable. This is something where you normalise questionable behaviour, then the whole paradigm of society shifts. So in the Netherlands, there was a woman with Alzheimer's who said, if I get more progress more, I would like assisted suicide, euthanasia. When the time came, she clearly resisted. They sedated her without her knowing they sedated her, and they held her down. When it came to then adjudicating the case between the profession and the courts, there was no sanction for the doctor. This was quite permissible, even though we who do care for people living with dementia would say, people can change their mind, they can express their emotions, and to get to a point where society, the professions, the courts are tolerating sedating somebody against her will and then holding her down.
But that's a bad system. You know, that's a system that's not working. Surely it might be possible to take those experiences and legislate for this in a way that is fair for people who want to take this option, but protects people who don't or who have decided that they do, but have changed their minds.
No, it's quite clear that there isn't the same appetite to tightly regulate or go after. There was a famous case when I was a trainee. There was a doctor called Paddy Leahy, who's no longer with us, but he proclaimed on the Gay Byrne show, to our horror as we were listening, how a friend of his who said, oh, if I get a stroke, please dispatch me. And a day after the severe stroke, he did dispatch him. And our jaws dropped, because you can make a fantastic recovery from what appears to be a severe stroke. There could be an element of seizure underlying it. The Gardaí did check it out, but it's clear from many of the jurisdictions there's no real appetite to tease out when this has been inappropriate, when it's been wrong.
Well, the UK are in a right mess now, because it's legislated for in the Isle of Man, legislated for in Jersey, but it appears to be about to fall in England. So they could be looking at a situation where they will have tourism within the British Isles for this.
Yeah. There's tourism for many things, can I remind you, whether it's going to dodgy bariatric surgery or in different countries. So we cannot, you know, legislate to the infinite to stop this type of tourism for things that we would see as undermining the caring impulse.
Des, thank you very much for coming in. That's Professor Desmond O'Neill. Now,
The Clare Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.